Good morning. Really cool to have you guys here. Welcome to Friday. We're going to continue on with an example. We started on Wednesday. We'll go through that. I will return your midterms towards the end of class. So we'll talk about that then. And also, I have a brand new iClicker base. So if you cannot log in or something like that, let me know. We'll check this out. I'm hoping all our problems go away. Anyway. We started with a pound, which is 454 grams of ammonium nitrate. And ammonium nitrate decomposes to dinitrogen monoxide, N2O, and two waters. The big two right there, as well as the invisible ones in front of the other things, are called stoichiometric coefficients. And they relate how many reactants and products you need. So on a molecular level, this ammonium nitrate, one of those, is decomposing into an N2O and two waters. So it's breaking down to three things. So in this problem, we're trying to see how much N2O and how much water will be created. And these stoichiometric coefficients, although they're really based on the molecules, they also relate to moles. So you can say that a mole of ammonium nitrate decomposes to a mole of N2O and 2 moles of water. And that's what we're doing right here. We're figuring out how many moles of this ammonium nitrate we have. So in this problem, 80.04, that's the molar mass of ammonium nitrate. So add up the 2 nitrogens, 4 hydrogens, and 3 oxygens, 80.04, and this comes out to be 5.68 moles. From this point then, we can go on and convert moles of reactant into moles of product. And you can do either N2O or water. Let's do the water right now. And to do this, you look at the fact that there's like a 1 right there and a 2 right there. And again, the punchline of this section, that means 1 mole of ammonium nitrate creates 2 moles of water. So if we have 5.68 moles, we can multiply it by this 2-to-1 ratio in order to find moles of water. In the lab this week, there was a mysterious, perhaps, 2/3 ratio in there. And that came from 3 moles of oxygen decomposing from 2 moles of KClO3. 3 moles of oxygen created, I guess, sorry. Whatever the stoichiometric factors are, they just come back to the balanced equation once again. And that's why this is so important. So if you have 5.68 moles, you can multiply it by 2/1. And again, the 2 moles of water per 1 mole of ammonium nitrate, we would create 11.4 moles of water. If we had done N2O instead of water, what would be the stoichiometric factor between ammonium nitrate and N2O?
1:1.
1:1, well done, that's right. So if you put 5.68 moles of that in, you get 5.68 moles of N2O out. But in this case, water is a 2-to-1 ratio. You can see then it's like twice the amount you have. Now, most of the time, people, of course, think of things in terms of grams, not moles. So you can take this 11.4 moles of water and turn it back into grams. And this number, what you want to do is you want to multiply now by the molar mass. Water is about 18 grams per mole, 204 grams of water. So if you think about it, we started with 454 grams of ammonium nitrate, and we ended up with 204 grams of water. But we didn't go straight from grams to grams. We went grams to moles first, using the molar mass of what we're starting with. We used the stoichiometric factor of 2:1 to go from moles of reactant to moles of product water. And then we multiplied by the molar mass. And if you follow these steps, these problems are totally mellow. They will fall for you. But I know at first it's a little strange, but it's grams to moles to moles to grams. Sometimes I'll babble about this kind of stuff to you. Grams to moles means take what you're starting with and turn it to moles. Moles to moles means look at the reaction itself, the balanced chemical reaction, to find that stoichiometric factor. And then the final moles to grams means turn your moles into so many grams at the end. Question? Yeah, David?
You always want to start with the finding the limiting reagent, and then you base all your calculations off of the limiting reagent.
Yes, you're seeing the even bigger picture, which we haven't talked about yet. Yeah, if you've got a limiting reactant, start with that, totally. We'll talk about what David's talking about in a little bit. Okay. N2O, if we wanted to know how much of that was formed, there's actually two different ways we could solve for it. You could start with the 5.68 moles ammonium nitrate, turn it into moles N2O because they are 1:1, so it would be 5.68 moles, and you multiply by the molar mass. However, in this kind of problem, remember that by what the Lavoisier talked about, all the mass that goes in has to be taken account for in the way back out. And we're going to assume, segueing to David's conversation with it, we're going to assume that all of this is reacting. So if 454 grams of ammonium nitrate went in, and we just calculated that 200 number for the grams of water that was created, you can also just figure out the difference between these numbers. So this is the amount of ammonium nitrate that went in. This is the amount of water we calculated that's going to come out. And this 454 needs to equal this number plus this number. So 454 minus 204, 250 grams. This is an alternate way to calculate the mass of something if that's the only piece left. And to be honest, if it's not a limiting reactant problem too. So in a special kind of things like this, all the mass that goes in has to be taken account for on the way back out. Chemistry, we always take into account different amounts. We don't want to make matter or destroy matter. Okay. So here's like a way to break down. Some people like seeing this kind of way. You can think about initial grams and moles and final moles and final grams. So in this problem, we are assuming that all of it converts over. Grams turned in became 5.68 moles. And at this level right here, which is the change, notice in the stoichiometry, it's one NH4NO3 making one N2O plus two waters. So you can see here that this one goes down by 5.68. This one goes up by 5.68 because of that 1:1 ratio. But when it comes to the water, we multiply 2 times 5.68 to find the moles that are created. And from the moles, you can go to grams using the molar mass. Now, if you look at this thing long enough, 454 grams is what we put in. And that equals 250 plus 204. So all the mass that has gone in is accounted for on the way back out. But my other question for you here, we put in so many moles of ammonium nitrate. Did we get the same number of moles of product out? We put 5.68 moles of reactant in. Did we get 5.68 moles of product out? No, right on. Moles are not conserved. If mass is conserved, that means that all the grams that go in are grams equal out. But the moles of reactants and products often are not conserved. You can see here we put 5.68 moles in, and we had essentially 3 times 5.68 moles coming out. Now, the moles of the atoms going in equal the moles of the atoms going out, but it's the compounds. The compounds, a lot of times, have different moles going in than out, and that's just part of the joy. Good. Any questions? Now, what tends to happen, though, is you're going to have, say, 250 grams, I think, of N2O come out. But these things, a lot of times, are gases, or maybe they're super reactive. So let's say that we only got 131 grams of N2O out. And if you remember what we calculated a while ago, we should have 250 grams of N2O. So the percent yield is another kind of tool that falls in this area, and it's basically a way to compare how effective a certain reaction mechanism is. So the percent yield compares the theoretical yield, the amount that you calculate you should get out, to the actual yield, how much stuff you actually get out of the reaction. So percent yield, again, is how much you actually get out divided by how much you should have gotten out times 100. The actual yield is something that you have to do the measurement for. You actually go to the lab, you figure it out, all right? The theoretical yield, though, is the grams to moles to moles to grams things. You calculate this number to see what's going on. So in this N2O reaction, we actually got out 131 grams. But theoretically, the calculation we did predicted we should have had 250 grams out. So 131 divided by 250 times 100, this reaction is 52.4% in its percent yield. Questions on that? Now, it's tempting in academia to think 52% F, all right? But don't do that with these kind of problems, all right? Because sometimes the actual chemistry, like making these compounds, is very difficult. And this is a very true and stupid story, but one time while I was in graduate school, I turned the purple compound blue, and I made the blue go back to purple, and that's all we need to know. It was a chromium-based thing. But anyway, I was so excited. I called my mom and dad at like 4 a.m. their time, and I was like, oh, I got the purple to go blue, blue, blue. Go back to purple. And I was just like babbling. I was so excited. And they were like, yeah, yeah, okay, you really need to go to sleep and stuff like that. My percent yield on that reaction, a whopping 4.3%. And that's totally dumb if you think about it academia, because 4.3%, oh, that's an F minus minus, you know, kind of thing. But no one had ever done it before. Incredibly water and air sensitive. It was a brand new thing. And after I did it a few more times, I got that 4% number to go up quite a bit more. It probably wasn't even 50%, but it was getting closer to 50%. So the percent yields are quite different than academia. Don't think that it's necessarily like you have to have 90% or higher to an A. Sometimes like a 93% would not be a good percent yield if other mechanisms are closer to 99%. So. Okay, so here's a reaction. We have some mechanism, who knows what it is. It is making, we should be making 74.0 grams, but we actually only get 29.1 grams out. So the question is then, what is the percent yield? So percent yield, again, actual divided by theoretical. So the actual, of course, is the amount that we truly did get out. And so it theoretically should have gotten 74. That would be from a calculation. But for whatever reason, we weren't paying attention, it's water sensitive, Martians came down, whatever reason you want to use, we only got 29.1 grams out. So the percent yield then, actual divided by theoretical, 29.1 divided by 74.0, I had 39.3%. Any questions on that?
Yeah. No problems with the
Isaac. Yes, I was just going to ask that. Did anyone have trouble with Isaac? Minor things make Isaac. Thank you. Okay. You can go pretty wild when it comes to these stoichiometry calculations. So for example, what we just saw is we took the grams of something, turned it into moles, moles of something to moles of something else, and we turned it back to grams. But there's a lot more you can do with this. So for example, if you have the volume of a solution and what's the molarity, which we'll talk about next term, next chapter, you can turn this into moles. If you have the volume and the density, you can find mass. And you can also convert number of particles, so number of molecules of something into moles using Avogadro's. And you can do the same thing on this side. So again, in chemistry, this is huge, because when someone hires you to do a chemistry thing, all right, they want to know like how much will we need to put in, how much grams of reactant will you need. And they'll also want to know things like how many grams of product will be created. That's where they'll make their money and stuff. So the control of chemical reaction is really represented right there in the many different ways that we'll do it. And we'll see some examples.
How do you estimate certain yields that have to happen given to you or done for?
The only way I would be able to estimate it would be using a theoretical program like CASH, which is a molecular modeling program. And that's very rare, and they're expensive programs, but that would be the only way I would know how to do it, man. So it's usually you have to just do it in the lab, man.
Good.
Hydrogen peroxide in water decomposes slowly at room temperature. In the presence of manganese dioxide, however, the decomposition occurs much more rapidly. The reaction produces gaseous oxygen and water. The hydrogen peroxide is oxidized and reduced at the same time. It undergoes a disproportionation reaction. The manganese dioxide serves only as a catalyst and is not consumed in the reaction.
I like this video because it shows what hydrogen peroxide can do, but I don't like this video because manganese dioxide, really? But anyway, I'm prop that back on. Manganese dioxide is the common name for manganese 4 oxide, and that's the same catalyst we used in this week's lab. And a catalyst, again, is just something that makes the reaction go a lot faster. You can reuse the catalyst at the end. So at the end of this reaction, there would be just water, and you could evaporate the water and use it again, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, what we're doing here is watching hydrogen peroxide break down. And the reason it's sold in brown bottles and you're supposed to keep in the temperature is those are just ways to keep the hydrogen peroxide intact as long as you can. So let's pretend that we're putting 5 grams of pure hydrogen peroxide and we want to see how much oxygen and how much water can be obtained. What is the stoichiometric factor between hydrogen peroxide and water in this reaction?
1:1.
1:1, that's right, or 2:2. Either answer is fine. It's 2 moles of hydrogen peroxide in for every 2 moles of water out. That's a 2:2 ratio, or as several of you said, 1:1, which is fantastic. 2 moles of hydrogen peroxide in make 1 mole of oxygen out. So if you wanted to find the oxygen, then you'll have a different ratio than you would the hydrogen peroxide. So what you would do on this kind of problem to solve it is you would take 5 grams of hydrogen peroxide and turn it into moles. So you would divide 5 grams by the molar mass of H2O2, which you get from adding 2 oxygens and 2 hydrogens together. It's about 34 grams per mole. Then, if you want to find the oxygen, you would take the moles of hydrogen peroxide used, and you would multiply it by 1/2. The thing you're starting with goes on the bottom, like a lot of these crazy dimensional analysis problems, and the thing you're looking for, in this case moles of O2, would go on the top. So moles times 1/2 would give you moles of oxygen. And from there, you could turn it into grams. So if you multiply that number by 2 times 16, you should get 2.35 grams. And if you do the same process with water, using 2:2 or 1:1 there, or go 5 grams minus 5 grams, this would give you 2.65 grams. And I hate to burden your weekend with stuff like this. However, if you could practice this problem, that would be really cool. Make sure you know it. Grams to moles to moles to grams. You can do oxygen or water, and then 5 minus the one you calculated will give you the other one. If you can get these numbers, you're good to go. But the next thing we need to talk about here is what David mentioned earlier. And in a lot of reactions, when you have more than one reactant, one of them will limit how much product you can make. All right? There are tons of video games that my son wants, all right, that he fortunately, unfortunately, doesn't have enough money to buy them all. So his desire is far greater than his money, which is probably a good thing. Anyway, money is often something that limits how much we can do with things. In chemistry, though, it's more about one reactant slows down the reaction more than the other. One thing that I think we can all relate with is what I call the garden burger example. Now, being a vegetarian, I have to use garden burgers in my lecture. If you decide to put some other kind of meat substitute in there, that's fine. But let's think about at least publicly here as a garden burger. Anyway, let's say that you and your friends come back from a long day doing chemistry, whatever, and you really want to make an ultimate big burger, all right? And in this case, your ultimate big burger has a garden burger patty, two slices of cheese. Yeah, I'm vegetarian, not vegan, don't get over it. Anyway, and a bun, all right? So the ultimate burger for you in this stupid example has one bun, one garden burger, and two slices of cheese. And this is like what you and your friends are really after. And you're like, oh man, yeah, that sounds good. But, oh, I haven't been to the store a lot, you know, exam week and stuff like that. So when you look in the refrigerator and freezer, you only have three garden burgers, you have six buns, and you have 12 slices of cheese. So your one friend who hasn't taken this class before says, oh yeah, well we got six buns and stuff, no problem, we'll be able to make six of these big burgers. But you, being in this class, say, oh no, wait, man, I think we only have so much of some reactants. Like it looks like the burgers, the buns, like you could make six of these. You have more buns than you have the burgers. And from the cheese also, it looks like 12 slices, two slices per burger. It looks like you could make six of these things from the cheese, but oh man, it's the garden burgers that you're gonna run out with, man. You only have three garden burgers. You can only make three of these ultimate burger things. Now, this is a ridiculous example, and I apologize if you're offended by vegetarian stuff, I understand that too. However, what I'm trying to show is that sometimes if you have more than one reactant, you will have something limit the amount of product you can make. You will have unreacted reactant left at the end that you need to take into account too, and this is the limiting reactant that David talked about.
What's the difference between a reactant and a reagent?
Good call. Reactant is a theoretical concept. Like if you write a balanced reaction, hydrogen peroxide to water and oxygen, hydrogen peroxide technically there would be a reactant. So it's part of like a balanced chemical reaction. Technically a reagent, Rebecca, is the chemical you add in the lab. So if we actually did the experiment, hydrogen peroxide, we would add it in, it's like a liquid, that would be our reagent. But the terms are interconvertible and stuff, and I'm really bad about using both of them too. So just realize that they're basically the same thing.
And in this case, both yours are in limits?
That's right, exactly, that's right. The burgers are gonna limit how much of the product you can make, absolutely. So Eleanor, there would be leftover reactant over here. And also, if you made your calculations based on one of the excess reagents, you'll come up with too big of a number. Like you can't make six of the burgers, even though the cheese says you can. You're limited over here by this number.
Good, excellent question. The what?
It won't stop me from trying.
And you could still have a cheese sandwich.
Yeah.
Improvise. There we go. That's it. Blake's invited to my house. Question? Don't even get me started on the hot dogs. But let's keep going. I'm already out of focus because this has been such a weird week. But you're absolutely right. This is not as tasty of an example. This is a reaction between nitrogen monoxide and oxygen. It oxidizes to make nitrogen dioxide. And these are just representations of the actual molecules. Now, red is often oxygen, and blue is often nitrogen. That's not universal, but it is here. Notice here how we have 1, 2, 3 O2s, and 1, 2, 3, 4 NOs. And if I said, yeah, we're gonna put these together to make NO2, you might look at these and go, well, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 molecules of NO and only 3 O2s. NO will be the part in excess, 4 versus 3. But it's not quite that simple either, because you have to look at the stoichiometry of the reaction. And if you look at this long enough, it's you need two NOs for every one O2. So even though the NO was numerically larger, we need two NOs to make two NO2s. O2 will not be used up quite as fast as the NO. So on this side, you can see that two NOs and one O2 make two NO2s, so that would take out these three right here. And you can imagine that these three would make another NO2, but we certainly don't have enough for the O2. So just be really careful here what it is. If something is left over at the end, it's an excess reactant. And if that something is not there at the end, it's the limiting reactant. Now in the empirical formula lab, there was a question about this, and I didn't mark anyone down wrong as long as you tried to answer it. But at the end of the reaction, you pulled the zinc out of the reactants, the beaker. The zinc was the excess reactant, all right? You had more left over. And the blue copper chloride solution that you started with, hopefully there was no more blue left and stuff. So the blue copper chloride was the limiting reactant in that particular example. Cool. Question?
For this demonstration, we put three different amounts of zinc into the same amount of hydrochloric acid. At the end of the reaction, there is still some zinc remaining in the flask on the left. The reaction on the right did not generate as much gas because there was an insufficient amount of zinc. In the center reaction, the balloon inflated fully and all the zinc was consumed.
So this is a reaction between zinc, metal, and hydrochloric acid. And you can see we have three different combinations here. Now, the middle one represents a perfect balance of zinc and HCl, all right? Zinc, you can kind of see here at the end, it's like a metal, and this side has excess zinc, all right? You can actually see it. These two don't have any zinc metal at the end. But the big net, the volume, excuse me, of the balloon represents how much HCl you have. So if the balloon is full, like it is here on the two left-hand side, that means that you used up all the HCl, or at least a lot of it. But here you can see the balloon is not very big. The balloon inflates because of the hydrogen. The hydrogen comes from the HCl. Now, instead of thinking we're using 0.100 moles of HCl. The left-hand side, we have more than enough zinc. Zinc is left over. So on the left-hand side, zinc is the excess reactant. And because the balloon is full, we're going to say that that one means that HCl is limiting how much. Like, zinc is still raring to go. It says, come on, let's make some more hydrogen gas. But we've run out of HCl at that point. Now, the second one in the middle is the perfect combination of both of them together. There's no zinc left. You can see that this volume is about the same as that volume. And again, we're trying to keep the same amount of HCl. This would be the ideal for a lot of chemical reactions. All right, you don't have any reactant left. Everything's been turned to product. And then the right-hand side, we have no zinc left, and you can see that the balloon is not as full. So if the HCl is constant on all of these, that means then that the zinc here is the limiting reactant on the right. And zinc prevented enough HCl to go. Hydrochloric acid here was ready to go and figure it out. And numerically, what these things would look like would be something like this. So I'm going to show you here the three reactions. This first row is the amount of zinc that was there. And you can see that the value of zinc on the left is by far greater, you can see there's more zinc there, than it is on the ones on the right. If you turn these grams into moles, you can see here what's going on. 0.02 is the smallest, 0.107 is the biggest. Now, if we had 0.100 moles of HCl, and there's a 2-to-1 ratio of HCl to zinc, this number times 2 equals 0.100. That's why the middle one is the perfect combination of reactants, all right? We have just enough zinc for the amount of HCl we have. There's no zinc left. The balloon was totally full. The other ones, though, represent, this is an excess of zinc on this side. Here we have not enough zinc to react with 0.100, so the HCl would be the excess on that side. So these are ways that chemists think about these kind of reactions, all right? In the best world, we would have a 2-to-1 ratio of HCl to zinc, because 0.100 moles of HCl, we need 0.05 moles of zinc. But as the ratio changes, then you can see there's different amounts possible. Cool. So here's an example with ammonia. Ammonia can be made from nitrogen and hydrogen gas. And we're mixing 10 moles of N2 with 25 moles of H2. And we want to see here what exactly the best answer is. Now, first of all, if we're looking for a limiting reactant, it cannot be the product, all right? So answer C doesn't make any sense here. Limiting reactant, or as Rebecca Tolley called me on, which is good, limiting reagent, those things have to be to the left of the arrows, so it's going to be nitrogen or hydrogen, or they could be balanced. Now, it kind of feels like this number, 25, is so much bigger than 10, all right? It kind of feels like maybe that might be an excess. Like numerically, 25 is quite a bit bigger than 10. But really, to nail this down, we need to use the factors from the reaction to balance this out. What would be the factor to use in converting nitrogen to ammonia? 2, that's right. It would be 2 moles of NH3 per 1 mole of N2. So if we have 10 moles of N2 and we multiply that by 2, we can make 20 moles of NH3. What would be the factor we use in going from H2 to NH3? Good, 2 over 3, or 3 moles of H2 for every 2 moles of ammonia, right on. We're going to start with H2, so we'll multiply by 2 over 3 to figure out what that value is. And if you multiply 25 by 2/3, it comes out to be just under 16.7. Now this value right here is smaller than the value here for the NH3. So this number is smaller than this one, and the reactant it came from is our limiting reactant. So in this problem, hydrogen is creating less ammonia than N2 does. N2 says, let's keep this going, let's make more ammonia. And hydrogen says, no, I'm exhausted, man. So in this problem, then, it's the H2, which is the limiting reactant. Notice that you can't just look at these numbers a lot of times to figure it out and stuff. It's a little bit more than that because of the stoichiometry factor.
All the ratios.
Ratios. Questions? Okay. We're going to look at an example where we're taking aluminum and chlorine and we're making another one of these weird twisted metal dimers. We looked at an example at the end of the last chapter with boron. This is the same kind of thing now with aluminum. And what we're going to do in this problem is we're going to mix 5.40 grams of aluminum with 8.10 grams of chlorine. And the ultimate goal here is to figure out how many grams of product we're going to make, how many grams of aluminum chloride. Now, here's a big alert for you guys. If you see 2 reactant gram amounts, this should scream to you, limiting reactant. It doesn't say anything about one reactant being smaller or limiting your product, all right? But if you see 2 reactant amounts, you've got to go through these steps to see which one of them is limiting, because almost always one of them is going to limit how much of the product, Al2Cl6, you've got. It doesn't say anything about limiting reactant, but as Blake said, those ratios can come in really handy with these things. Okay, so what we need to do is we're going to compare the mole ratios of reactants in these products. We're going to try and go after these ratios. And the big one we're going to use today is we're going to use the 3:2 ratio. In this problem, the way we're going to do it, we're going to compare the moles of chlorine to the moles of aluminum. and that's going to be a 3/2 factor, all right, a 1.5. Now, prof hat off, there are many ways to do limiting reactant problems, and you may not end up doing it this way, and that's totally fine. So there are many ways to do these limiting reactant problems. But the way we're going to do it here is we're going to look at the ratio between chlorine and aluminum and see how this works out. If that ratio is greater than 3/2, remember 3/2 is like 1.5. So if this ratio comes out to be 1.81 or something weird, that means we have more in the top part and less in the bottom part. If you make the top number bigger, it makes this ratio bigger. And if you make the bottom number smaller, that also makes this ratio bigger. So a ratio greater than what you expect means you're going to have more chlorine, less aluminum. Your ratio is going to be limited in these cases by the aluminum. The aluminum does not have enough of it around to react with the chlorine if that ratio is greater than 1.5. It's not always greater than 1.5, as we'll see here in a little bit, but if it is, that's going to be the part that limits your reaction. Now, conversely, if you have a ratio which is less than 1.5, you can probably imagine in those cases, chlorine is going to be your limiting reactant. You won't have enough chlorine in these cases to do it. So what we're going to do, we're going to assume that that ratio is not equal to 1.5. That would make our lives really easy on this problem. We'll assume it's not 1.5. If the ratio is greater than 1.5, the limiting reactant will be aluminum. But if the ratio is less than 1.5, chlorine will be our limiting reactant. And going back again to what David said earlier, if you have these limiting reactants, those are what you're going to base your calculations on. So let's look at what this stuff looks like numerically. What I would do is first turn things into moles, all right? So turn the grams of aluminum into moles of aluminum using the molar mass of aluminum, grams of chlorine into moles of chlorine. And again, remember those diatomics have no fear of ice, clear brew. Chlorine is clear, so that's why there's two Cls, not just one. But aluminum is not one of the diatomics, so we can call it just Al. Now we have the actual aluminum and chlorine moles. And remember, we're going to compare it to a 3:2 ratio. We'll put the chlorine on the top and the aluminum on the bottom. And if you do that, you can see here and stuff that this ratio is certainly much less than 3/2 or 1.5. If you take those actual numbers out, definitely less than 3/2. So if that's less than 3/2, that means that, first of all, something is limiting here how much product you can make. And 3/2 means you're going to have, what do you think, limiting reactant of chlorine or aluminum?
Chlorine.
Well done. That's right. Remember, the ratio needs to be 3/2, 1.5, if the values are equal. This is much less than that. So that means we have lower amount of what's on top, which in this case is the chlorine. So when David said, and I'm glad he said it, that you always look for these limiting reactants to do these calculations, you bet. Now that we know the chlorine is limiting reactant, we're going to go grams to moles to moles to grams to get to the Al2Cl6. If you would have done that with the aluminum, you would have ended up with a really big number over here that would have been too large. Okay. So here's the grams to moles to moles to grams. And again, I'm trying to focus here on, now that we know the limiting reactant is chlorine, you want to base everything on chlorine. If you use aluminum here, you're going to end up with a number at grams of product which is too big. And again, that's like having, you know, 6 buns but only being able to make 3 of those burgers. You're not taking into account the other reactant, and chlorine here is limiting how much of this product you can make. So to go to the product, you take the moles of your limiting reactant, based all your calculations on limiting reactant from now on, multiply it by 1 over 3. And again, that comes from 3 moles of Cl2, making 1 mole Al2Cl6. You get this number, 0.0380 moles of product. That's the moles of product you would actually make. And then finally, you can turn that into grams. 10.1 grams of Al2Cl6 will be made in this reaction. Now, just to kind of highlight, if you see grams of two reactants, those problems should scream at you, theoretical yield, or thanks for playing, limiting reactant. Sorry, it won't say anything about something limiting your product usually. It'll just say, we're mixing 3 grams of sodium and 4 grams of water. What's the yield? Those are the kind of problems which are limiting reactant, even though they don't state limiting reactant. And you can do a mole ratio, which is the way we've done it right now, to find out limiting reactant, and then all of your calculations should be based on that limiting reactant from there. Okay. Now, this way we just did it is what I consider the classic way to find a limiting reactant. I have found, though, as a teacher, that there's a little bit better way to do it. It involves a little bit more math, but you instantly get the answer, and you can compare things quickly to see which is the limiting reactant. So let me share with you an alternate way to find limiting reactant. And in this way, you're going to take both reactant amounts, and you're going to convert them both into grams of product. And you're going to get two numbers out, and only the smaller one is the right one. So let me show you what this would look like in this problem. Here's the chlorine, all right, which we know in this problem is the limiting reactant. This is the grams to moles to grams thing I talked about earlier. You're turning grams to moles of your first reactant. You're then using a mole-to-mole ratio for that reactant to the product, and then calculating the grams of product using the molar mass. But you do the same thing for the other reactant too. So if you did this for aluminum and you didn't know aluminum was in excess, grams of aluminum to moles, it's a 2:1 ratio in this particular reaction, and you multiply it by the molar mass, 26.6 grams of product. Now, this way does take more math. This is another step. However, you can instantly see that this is a smaller number. This is your theoretical yield. That's how much of your product you should get out. This is definitely too big. It's not a theoretical yield. The theoretical yield comes from your limiting reactant. So because chlorine created the smaller amount of product, chlorine is your limiting reactant. And aluminum here, which gives way too much product, aluminum would be your excess reactant. I don't have to think about ratios as much, like Blake mentioned earlier. I just throw these in, I get these numbers out, I compare the numbers for the smallest one, it gives you theoretical yield right away, and it tells you which one is the limiting reactant.
Plus, if you have one of the higher level calculators, just remember that, just plug it all in all at once.
Totally. Totally. Your calculator will be your good friend on this stuff.
So it's much fun.
Totally. Well, no brand mentioned. Anyway, questions on? Okay. This is going to be a good place to stop this stuff. We'll talk about one more kind of part of this on Monday. But let's give me a second here. We'll talk about the mission.
Yeah.
This exam was worth a total of 130 points. And so the breakdowns for A, B, C, D, 89, 78, 62, 50%. So here would be the corresponding numbers for that. So of this 130-point exam, one person got an outstanding 130 out of 130. And I looked through these pretty closely. I'm like, there must be some sig figures on the wrong. No, it was 130 out of 130. So very well done. Lots of people very close to this number, too, which was really, really gratifying to see. The low, a little less than 130, and that's all we need to say about that. The average was 96.8, about 75%. So that was actually really good. You guys did better than last fall quarter at this time, which was kind of neat to know too. When you get your exam back, I'm going to distribute them by the different lab sections. So if you have a lab on Tuesday morning, I'll put you here, lab Tuesday afternoon right here, or something like that. And they're all in here alphabetically by last name, so you can grab your exam. When you see your exam, the Scantron will be stapled to the front and you can look on it. And if you open up this back page, it will then tell you your point distribution on the exam and stuff like that. But to be honest, I would go straight to the very last page. And the very last page is what I call a summary sheet. And this literally lists all the assignments for the whole quarter. And of course, we haven't gone through all the assignments for the quarter yet. But it'll tell you in the lower right-hand corner a percentage. And this percentage, you can look up here and stuff to see like how you're doing. If you're missing a lab, I have it circled. It's very important that you turn your labs in and stuff like that to get full points and stuff. But this gives you a good sense right now as to how you're doing in the class. Now, if you have a question on one of the different things you missed, I love it when you look through your exams. And instead of you all coming down here, and there's only one of me and a lot of you, what I would ask of you today is to please go upstairs or wherever you or on your phones or whatever to our website, mhchem.org/221. And the answer key for this exam is now live. So please look at my answer there first and see if my cryptic information makes sense on how you get the answer you got, all right? If it doesn't make sense, then Monday I have lots and lots of time, and I will sit down with you if you want, and we'll go over different problems and stuff that you missed that don't make sense to you, and that's totally cool. Now, to encourage you to look at your midterm, which I know is like watching paint dry, especially on the weekend sometimes, I will be announcing in less than an hour via email an extra credit assignment. It's an exam analysis form. And if you missed, I think it's 17, if you missed more than 8, look on the forum, I'm not sure, but I think it's if you missed 8 or more of the multiple choice questions, I will encourage you to go back and look at your exam and just fill out this exam analysis form. It tries to get you to think about why you missed it. Was it a conceptual thing? You didn't understand the question? Or was it maybe just you read through it too fast? Any reason you give me is fine. I just want you to examine like what happened on your exam and stuff like that. Any questions on that kind of stuff? Very cool. So then, this is all of Tuesday morning's class. I will put them right here. I'll put them right here. If you are in Tuesday afternoon's class, I will place them right here. If you are in Thursday morning's lab, I will place them right here. And those of you from Wednesday's lab, I will place on this little red table. Have a great weekend, guys.